Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon, reach through restaurantguysradio.com, or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm very well. Very well.
I want to get right into it this morning. I want to start talking about, this is on stuff.com. It's actually a New Zealand website. It's stuff.co.nz. And I can't even believe it.
This particular topic is making you stutter even before you start to talk about it.
You know, I think that people should be with who they want to be with, you know. Actually, I'm...
What does that have to do with food?
Well, it's like I'm for gay marriage. I think that the two people, gay people, want to get married. I think that's great. I think, you know...
What does that have to do with
food? For a long time, people were against interracial marriage.
What does that have to do with food?
In New Zealand, there is a new phenomenon, taking in the idea of what you eat to the extreme. Vegan sexual is a term for a person who does not eat any meat or animal products, who also chooses not to be sexually intimate with any non-vegan partners, whose bodies, they say, are made up of dead animals.
Interesting.
Do you not pet your cat? Because your cat's body is made up of dead animals. Your dog's body is made up of dead animals. It's intolerance masquerading as tolerance.
That's exactly what it is. It's intolerance masquerading as tolerance. That's very, very well said, Francis, and I hate to compliment you, but once in a while it happens.
It's just insane.
So what you're saying here is these people are saying, I won't have sex with somebody unless they are also vegetarian, because I'll be dirtying, soiling myself in some way by being
right
with that person.
Right. One vegan respondent from Christchurch, New Zealand said, I believe we are what we consume, so I really struggle with bodily fluids, especially sexually. You shouldn't be with anybody, and you shouldn't reproduce. It's too animal a thing to do to reproduce. I would not want to be intimate with someone whose body is literally made up of the bodies of others who died for their sustenance.
So what they're saying, it's kind of a graveyard for...
Yeah, you're a graveyard.
Yeah, I see. I'm reading over your shoulder.
Yeah, that's a quote. When you're a vegan or vegetarian, you're very aware that people who eat meat are kind of a graveyard of animals. Oh, come on. I mean, just come on. I mean, first of all, I totally respect, and don't get me wrong, if someone wants to make a choice not to eat meat, I think that's a very respectable choice, and people do that for a variety of reasons. I don't think, however, that it's wrong, morally wrong, to kill an animal for food or to eat meat products. I think it's morally wrong to torture or treat inhumanely animals, and I think there is a way to humanely raise an animal and slaughter it humanely for food. But it's the height of intolerance to me to say that I'm somehow polluted because I do what my body is designed to do.
You know, you can be with or not be with whomever you choose. That's up to you, of course, but... You know, is this a form of racism? Is this a form of, you know, saying I wouldn't be with somebody because...
No, I mean, because I think that there are people who choose to date within their own race because that's what they want to do. I don't think that's racist, but it's a complex issue. It's a more complex issue than it looks like on the surface of it. But the idea that you wouldn't be with me because I'm somehow polluted because I've eaten animals.
Oh, well, it wasn't because you've eaten animals.
Funny.
It's a whole different set of
reasons. Funny, I don't want to be with you anyway. No, but... You know, it's the bodily fluids of someone who's touched animals, which is what you're saying is that it's somehow unnatural that I eat meat. Look, there's an argument out there that says we as humans have a sense of morality which separates us from the other animals, which is kind of speciesist if you want to know the truth.
But aren't we speciesist?
I am, but they're claiming not to be. Which separates us from other animals, and so therefore we have the morality not to eat animals. But to imply that there's something physically unnatural about me eating animals, is there something, do you not want to touch your cat because your cat eats other animals, fish, birds, whatever?
Well, it's all just very silly. So, and I wish that the, what's the word for them?
Kooks? vegan sexuals.
I think they should stay to themselves.
All right.
I think it's a great idea. Yeah.
You know what? Maybe you're right about that one. Okay, weird news. This is from the Kansas City Star. There is a man who's pleaded guilty to his role in a multi-state scheme to defraud restaurants. He's received over $200,000 in compensation. The man's name is Ronald Ivano. He's 49. He pled guilty to 20 federal counts, including conspiracy, mail fraud, wire fraud, and identity theft. What he would do is he would go into restaurants. His wife would then eat glass on, or he was it he?
I think he was eating.
Oh, he was eating. He would eat glass on purpose, and then he would go to the hospital and say he was in pain.
So before they would go out to dinner, he would eat glass. Then he would go to the dinner, go out to dinner, say, oh, you know, there's glass in my food, and then say he was in pain. Then go to the hospital. They would obviously find the glass, I guess, in his digestive tract,
as it were.
And so then he would sue the restaurant or you know, whomever the owner of the restaurant was for compensation based on the fact that he had eaten glass going in there.
Prosecutors say that Ernesto and his wife Mary filed fraudulent insurance claims worth more than $200,000 and collected more than $200,000 and left a trail of unpaid medical bills totaling more than $100,000 in several states. They collected payments from insurance companies but never paid the hospital bills. So then they stiffed the restaurant, stiffed the hospital, and in one instance they took $45,000 paid directly from the restaurant. I guess they weren't insured.
It's got to be a better way to make money, guys, okay? Because, first of all, you know, there's the whole creepy, you know, fraudulent insurance fraud, all the stuff that comes with that. But you're eating glass. That's really, really, really dangerous. There are a lot of things that can happen from eating glass.
I don't care.
Including diverticulitis all sorts of, you know, these guys they're also not very bright. Not the brightest thieves in the world.
I don't care. I wish
choose something that, if you're going to rob somebody, choose a way where you're not going to hurt
no,
yourself.
No. If you're going to rob somebody, eat glass. Anyway, but here's the deal. I mean, people are working their butts off every day. And they try so hard to do something right, and then you call and you say to a restaurateur, I ingested glass at your restaurant. I would be pulling my hair out.
Right.
It would
figuring out what happened. What happened.
The money, but also we would rip. You know those restaurants did. Not only did they pay the money or pay the higher insurance rates, they ripped their restaurants apart. People got fired. Maybe they changed the way they do things, and maybe those restaurants went out of business. Here's the good news. Ivano is in custody, and to be sentenced next month, he could receive up to 100 years in prison. I hope he serves every day of it.
100 years. That's a really long time.
I mean,
100 years is a long time for fraud and.
Maybe that is just feed him glass.
That's what I think you should do. Just actually make him eat glass in prison for the next 5 years.
All right, listen, we're going to come back and talk with Kim Severson of the New York Times about local food, Italian food, and her journey back to her family's roots to find where her sauce came from. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurant. Our guest today is Kim Severson. She is one of The Restaurant Guys' favorite repeat guests. She's been a food writer and a cultural commentator at the New York Times since 2004, and she's one of our favorite food journalists.
Kim, welcome to the show.
Always glad to be here. How are you guys doing?
We're doing great. Well. Hey, we saw that you... Now, you normally... your columns, your articles normally appear in the national sections of the New York Times, but over the course of the summer, we saw an article appear in the regional section of the time, in our little Jersey Weekly section on...
Well, tri-state
right.
area.
Yeah.
Right.
And on green markets and food in general. What did you get demoted? What happened?
Right. No, I'm just trying to spread the love, you know? Just trying to spread the love. Actually, it was the person who edits the regional sections had been hearing a lot about the explosion in community-supported agriculture. That's where people buy a share in a farm, and then they get a box of vegetables or fruit and vegetables every week, and in farmers markets all over. And she had correspondents in many far-flung areas who were reporting in that there were busier farmer markets than ever. So she came to talk to me a little bit about this local food phenomenon. You know, those of us who are in the food business, there are trends and things that happen that we're seem like old news to us, and, you know, the idea that people are getting more interested in local food you know, that kind of story, I think, for most chefs or readers of the dining section is not particularly news-breaking. But I think for people who aren't regular readers of the dining section or who aren't obsessed with the food blogs like a lot of food people, it's kind of a new concept. And there have been some books out. Barbara Kingsolver had a book, Animal Vegetable Miracle, and, you know, Michael Pollan's Omnivore's Dilemma. And so this notion of eating locally, eating closer to home is trickling down. So she just asked me if I could work with some of the people who live out in those areas and pull together a story that looked at what was happening in the tri-state area, and I told her I was happy to do that. So that's where that story came from, but it was just amazing. We had people sending in reports, and actually if you go on the Times website, you can find, if you're in, say, Connecticut or Jersey, they have these pretty big and deep lists of where you can go to find farmers markets in your area. It's just amazing what's happening out there. What do you guys? You guys must be just in high heaven getting all kinds of produce.
One of the things we've seen out here in New Jersey is what you alluded to just a moment ago is the farmers markets. Okay, it seems like every third town now has a farmers market once a week, and frankly, you can go within 20 miles and be at one of these local farmers markets, these town farmers markets, whenever you want. In addition to the roadside stands and the existing markets that were already there, these other things are popping up. And not to the detriment of the, you know, there's a place in my town called Dryer Farms that I talk about all the time in Cranford, and they are an existing farm. They own about 10 acres right in the center of Cranford, and they're busier than ever. So these other farmers markets aren't taking away. They're drumming up more and more interest, and people are going to these farm stands even more frequently than ever.
Now, the thing that I thought was interesting is I talked to some folks from Whole Foods, and they, they've taken some hits for trying to pretend to have a lot of local food on their shelves, but really they also have stuff from Chile and other places. But the guy who's in charge of grocery distribution in the tri-state area said he has a big problem getting. Like there may be great corn in Connecticut, but try to sell that at a Whole Foods in New Jersey. People want their New Jersey corn. Like, it's really, there's a lot of state pride when it comes to local produce. Is there a lot of cross state lines rivalry there when it comes to produce, in you guys' opinion?
You know, I don't think there is a lot of cross state rivalry, but I think people sort of, you do have this proprietary thing where the idea of having a Jersey tomato. We've always been crazy about our tomatoes, because, you know, the Jersey beefsteak tomato was invented here. But prior to the Jersey beefsteak, you know, people always said Jersey tomatoes are the best, Jersey corn is best. And I think it's sort of like having a local sports team. But I think that, frankly, when it comes down to the buying decisions, we buy a lot of our produce we go into the Union Square Green Market because a lot of the farmers we deal with go there, and it's just easier to meet them all in one place. So though we're in New Jersey, we'll be in the Green Market every Wednesday in Manhattan buying from, oddly enough, Jersey farmers. But there is a certain amount of you want to buy as locally as you can, and if you're in Jersey, especially if you have guests in from out of town, you want to say, you know, here's a Jersey peach, this is Jersey corn.
But, Kim, I got to tell you, I'm shocked sometimes. Just recently, this happened to me in the last 10 days. I'm shocked at some of the things that go on. We're here in Jersey. You know, it's late in the season for a lot of things, but there are a lot of things available right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I buy a lot of stuff, most of my stuff now from the green markets, wherever, whichever market it might be, but usually Union Square. And I augment with purveyors. And last week I had a purveyor bring me blueberries from California, strawberries from California, arugula from California, I don't even remember what it was, but something else from Guatemala that's in season right here in town. And I sent it all back. I said, what are you doing? You're a New Jersey purveyor, or even a New York, New Jersey purveyor, because actually this guy's a New York, New Jersey purveyor. I said, why would you send me these things when most of them are at the height of season and you could buy them from right around the corner? And I still haven't gotten a satisfactory answer, frankly.
Really? That's really amazing. And one thing I do hear about people who are not only trying to sell their produce, but also from people such as yourselves, it's difficult to get the distribution system to respond in the way, you know, it's one thing to have all these farmers markets around, but to be running a restaurant where you've got to have a pretty reliable supply coming in, and I do, you know, it's great you guys get to drive to the Union Square Market, but, you know, a restaurant that wants to to do local and doesn't have the time or the resources to get out there, they're in trouble. They've got their, you know, they've got strawberries from California.
I mean, and when you say they're in trouble, they're in trouble.
We'll be back in just a moment talking more with Kim Sears and the New York Times about eating locally and sustainably and well. Central Jersey, 1450. It's 1125.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Mark and Francis and the Restaurant Guys. We're talking with Kim Severson of the New York Times. We're talking about an article that she wrote recently in the regional edition of the Times that appears in Long Island and New Jersey and Westchester. Kim, one of the things that has struck me about green markets and about farm stands and is that they're responding to a consumer demand in a way that's taken it from, you know, it used to be the idea of eating locally, eating organically was sort of hippy-dippy kind of a, you know, not it's not about the money kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. I think that what I've seen, though, is more business enterprises that realize that you can have a sustainable business that you can make money from in a farm stand, in a farm, and there are economic implications to these farm stands. Did you find that more a theme as you wrote this article?
Well, I think it's true that farmers are realizing, especially selling retail, they can actually make fit into this larger distribution system. So if you can't grow, you know, and I'm not an economist here, but let's say a gajillion tomatoes, for example. If you can't sell, grow and produce and get a gajillion tomatoes into the distribution center, you know, you can't make money. So these guys who are, a lot of the farms that we talked to for the story were saying, you know, thank God there's this interest at a retail level so I can go to a local farmer's market or I can have people come to the farm. I can charge a retail price. I'm cutting out the middle person and my farm is actually you know, a viable enterprise at this point. I think before it was, if you couldn't get in with a big distributor, you were in trouble.
But what's happened too is that's given us a lot more flexibility in the things that we're seeing, a lot more variety in the things that we're seeing in those farmers markets, because things that might not fit in the norm that a farmer wouldn't want to grow because he's only going to grow 100 pounds of some specialty tomato, he can now grow and sell on his farm stand.
Right, and get a good price.
For a premium
but you know, people. It's funny. It's one thing I came around. I wrote about this in the story is how funny we all get when it comes to food prices. And you know, you think about what we spend money on. And I think I make this point in the story. Like, I will think nothing of spending $4 for a cup of warm milk and coffee, you know, at the corner Starbucks. But if we go into a grocery store and we see really beautiful local tomato or an heirloom tomato, and it's, you know, 20 or 30 cents more a pound. We're like, I'm not paying that. And, hey, you know, we become these, like, misers in the grocery store.
We're going to pick this story up on the other side of the news. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1130.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon, Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Today we're talking with Kim Severson, one of our favorite food journalists, and she works for the New York Times, and she's taking time out of her busy schedule to talk with us today about some articles she's written recently. We were talking, Kim, before the news about the sort of resurgence of buying from a farm, or the emergence of buying from a farm, and the articles you wrote specifically about the tri-state area, about farmers markets and people's increased concern with buying locally.
You know, and you were talking right before the break, and I'm sorry we had to cut you off, but one of those consumer issues that we all have is we'll spend those extra dollars at a Starbucks or, in a restaurant to get that special little extra appetizer that looks really, really neat, but is a $15 supplemental on the tasting menu. And at the same time, we'll be in the grocery store and kind of say, I don't want to spend 35 cents extra to get the organic apples mm-hmm. rather than the regular apples.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think that is? I think
part of it is it's just the coupon culture, and I think a lot of us grew up with those cents off coupons. So, and perhaps our parents really used them at the grocery store. Now, we all have those little, those crazy little loyalty cards where it's like gambling. I'm like, how much did I get off? Oh, look at that, $10. And it's a really compelling thing. This idea that you could get cents off, like 50 cents off on something, seems, in that environment, in that grocery store environment, that just seems like a huge deal, So I think part of it is just that mindset. And also I think we've, increasingly come to expect food to be cheap. Used to be people spent, 30 or 40% of their income on food a long time ago, and now that's gotten so cheap, and there's like the dollar value menu, and we just have this idea that food should be cheap, it's a really good deal, a beautiful tomato will make you happy all night, well, not all night, okay, it'll make you happy for the half hour you eat it.
Mm-hmm.
It's worth paying a little bit more money for.
Sure.
But I think it's just this, it's a combination of that, the coupon culture, and the fact that we've just gotten very used to cheap food in this country.
I think you've coined two new phrases here, the coupon culture and the game show mentality. I'm going to be using those frequently in the shows from now on.
It's true. Now, how do you guys find, when you price your menus, and say you had something that was a piece of local pork or something that was particularly special, are you hesitant to increase the price on your menu to reflect that it might cost a little more?
I'm going to tell you, we're in a very fortunate market, and that's why a lot of these foods are being used in high-end restaurants, where the difference between $29 and $30 for an entree, people don't really take a look at that and care that much. I think that when you get into a mid-range restaurant or even kind of a family-style restaurant or for your home table, it becomes more difficult. Those types of decisions are a little more difficult to make.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I know you had some statistics in your article about when was it that we spent 40% of our budget on food?
Oh, you're going to make me go back to my notes now. This was
in the 50s, right?
Yeah, I have your notes. Late 40s.
Right, and it was just right around, and especially post World War II, but when we had more of a farm based economy, and before all of the technology we developed for World War II started going into large farms, and the price of food and subsidies and commodities began. It was back when we were doing what we're starting to do again now, which is a local farmer grows the stuff. You live in that community, you go buy from the local farmer. It just seems like such a novel concept to people now. I think they forget that's really how it worked for a long time. And also this idea that, food like local food should be such a luxury item. I think that's really turned on its head. If you think about farmers markets as kind of the theater of the rich in a way, it's places where people have a little bit more money, they have more time, and they're going to get this, lovely handcrafted cheese. I mean, the idea that salamis, I used to take my mom to the farmer's markets, and there'd be these Italian salamis, and she's like, oh, my God, I had to grow up eating those. They were in the basement. We hated them. Now you're paying all this money for that. What are you doing? In her generation, it was, the supermarkets and those nice, clean cold cups were really what she valued. And these kind of knobby, handmade, garlicky salami. She just can't believe how much I pay for them. She laughs at me all the time.
I love knobby, handmade, garlicky salami.
Oh, sure, sure.
It's funny. You pointed to in an article you wrote in February called "A Grandchild of Italy Cracks the Spaghetti Code," which is what I want to talk about next. You talk about how your mom tried so hard to get off the farm, and now you're trying so hard to get back on it.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. It's a fascinating, fascinating situation. I had just you know, I had all my life wanted to go back and, you know, go back to the roots, and my grandparents were from Italy, and, you know, wanted to understand all this, and I used to always be trying to get recipes from my mother, and I'd be like, tell me what it was like back, you know, and, I mean, for her, she didn't have a refrigerator until elementary school, and she, you know, she said, I hated having to go down in the cellar, and they kept the sausages in a big crock covered with pork fat. She goes, you know, and pieces of pork down there. And she goes, I'd have to go down and dig those out. And, oh, it was horrible. Honey, they have that nice styrofoam with the sausages at the grocery store. It's fantastic. It's just funny to me, the whole, you know, she used to say, well, they used to dry parsley on, you know, and herbs on big cookie sheets on the farm. And I just think, oh, that's great. I should be drying my own herbs. And she's like, oh, why would you want to do that? They've got those nice plastic, you know, jars at the grocery store. I mean, to her it was work. To me, it's, I don't know, it's evocative of what, of a different time, of, you know, maybe a romantic notion of what life was like for my grandparents. I'm not sure. It's funny.
I will tell you that of all the articles you've ever written, this one was probably nearest and dearest to my heart. It was.
Oh, really?
Just, you know, you did a little excerpt, and we need to put some kind of link up to this article on the website, so we'll put that up on restaurantguysradio.com. But you go into a diatribe of you talking to your mother and trying to get a recipe out of her, and, you know, you do that. Do you mind if I read a little excerpt?
Oh, go ahead.
It was great. I'll kind of start right in the middle. You know, you're pretty much asking your mother for a recipe, and, you know, you say, but an exact recipe, not so much. For example, thin-skinned Italian peppers were always around the farmhouse when she grew up, so she likes to use the same kind of pepper to give sauce, which she calls homemade flavor. She also uses pickled peppercini. Once when I was out of them, I called to see if she had a substitute. She suggested green bell peppers, but I never put green bell peppers in, I told her. Well, if you had one, you would, she said. But don't go out of your way. It doesn't make that much of a difference. Okay, Mom, let's focus. Mm-hmm. When do you put the chicken thighs in? I asked another time. Oh, honey, I never use chicken thighs. But the last time I was home, the sauce had chicken thighs in it. Oh, that's funny, she said. I guess I must have had some in the freezer. And just there you have every cooking lesson I ever got from my mother in, you know, one or two little paragraphs where my mother just, you know, well, I used it because I had it in the freezer. It was there and we needed to do something with it. So I incorporated it into the next recipe. But they were such, you know, they cooked every day. They cooked all the time. They were great cooks.
Right.
They interpreted the ingredients that they had in front of them. And one of the things that you hit on here that I adore that has changed in the world is we now do so much of our cooking from recipes. It's recipe driven. This is the way it has to be because this is what the recipe tells me. And so little of it comes from, hey, you know, this is what's here. This is what's fresh. Let me use this. You know, and I guess we're talking about two of your articles in the same sentence there. You know, do you think that we're going back to the, you know, we can use what's around us, or do you think that we're going to be, you know, tied to recipes for the rest of our lives?
Well, I think once people learn to cook again, we'll be able to do that. And I think that's what the appeal of someone like Rachel Ray and the 30-minute meal is.
There's an appeal to Rachel Ray.
There's a huge appeal. Listen. There's a massive amount of people who watch Rachel Ray.
It's a lot richer than any of us will ever be.
I know.
It makes me.
I went to get a coffee from Dunkin' Donuts, and there's a big picture of her staring at me.
It's scary. Well, you weren't drunk. That was just a dream.
No, that really happened. She's okay. Endorsing something there now.
Yeah. So, but I think it's this idea that we can kind of loosen up in the kitchen a little bit. And, you know, there was that whole, generation of women who rejected the kitchen, this idea that, you know, in order to have power in the world as a woman, it wasn't going to happen in the kitchen. That and then convenience foods. And so there's a whole generation of people who grew up without learning how to cook, you know. And now I think people really want to get back to that, and they want to cook, and they want to feel more comfortable in the kitchen. But it's going to take, I think, a few years, and certainly the cooking culture we have now is crazy. I mean, you know, you just look at the rise in the interest of food right now. I think people really do want to cook. They really do want to cook again, but you have to feel like you can do it. I mean, we have a person who writes a column, Melissa Clark, in the paper, and I love how she writes her recipes. She did a recipe for gazpacho yesterday, and she said, well, I was making gazpacho, and I added some watermelon because I had some. And to get that mentality again in the kitchen where you're like, well, huh, I wonder if this would go with this, and have that confidence, I mean, it's a great thing. And I'm really into managing my home kitchen. It seems like once a week at least I make kind of refrigerator pasta. There's, you know, a little bit of this left and a little bit of that, and I figure it out and make dinner. But I'm not sure how many people really feel like they have that daily rotation where they're managing their kitchen. They're thinking about what's in the fridge, what's going to be 2 days down the road. Do I have a little stock in the freezer? I can make this dish. I mean, I love that kind of that way of cooking, but I'm not sure how many people actually do it or have time to do it. So I hope it's coming back. I think, you know, I'll leave here sometimes and they'll say, what are you doing? I'm like, oh, I'm going to go home and make some pork chops. And, you know, in Manhattan, they're like, oh, my God, I haven't made pork chops in 20 years. Isn't that cute? She's going to make pork chops. Look at her, all darling. You know, it's like, I don't know. I don't know what's happening.
When we come back, we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, I want to talk about how you went all the way back to Italy in pursuit of what happened and how your family's recipe for sauce evolved.
Great.
We'll be back in just a moment. Central Jersey 1450, it's 11:46.
I think it's great that more and more restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass. Unfortunately, I often find those by the glass wines flat or spoiled. It's been my experience that most wine preservation systems just don't work until now. The Vinfinity system was invented by Armando Luis, a mechanical engineer with over 25 years experience in the wine industry. Vinfinity has 3 U.S. patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. Vinfinity creates a precise vacuum in the bottle that preserves the wine. Too much vacuum or too little and the wine is damaged. Vinfinity never needs gas and requires little maintenance. One Vinfinity system preserves any number of wines. We use just one system for both of our restaurants, and we're not alone. Some of the best restaurants in the country are taking on the Vinfinity system. The guest gets a large selection of wines by the glass in great condition, and the restaurant eliminates waste. Tell your favorite restaurant about it. If you own a restaurant, install it. Find out more at VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. We're talking with Kim Severson of the New York Times about nostalgia, about cooking, about farms, about green markets. You wrote, Kim, in an article called A Grandchild of Italy Cracks the Spaghetti Code. Your grandmother came from Italy?
Right. Actually, both of my grandparents did. My grandmother immigrated... they both came from Italy. Yeah, what am I saying? Yeah.
Well, and so you one day, this is a wonderful article, where you one day took a look at the pot of sauce boiling on your stove and thought about, you know, your different cousins' interpretations of it and your mother's interpretation of it that you interpreted from your grandmother who brought it from Italy, who probably made some changes herself. And you really went further than most in seeing where this came from. And were you surprised at what you found in Italy, and were they surprised at what you had, how you had ruined their sauce?
Right, yeah. It's, you know, I had this romantic notion. I got on a plane and I went to a little town called Ataleta, which is, it was a couple hours drive up into the mountains from Rome. And it's about an hour from Naples, and it was the place where my grandmother was born. And, you know, she was older and just in the lineup there. I found a person who was basically my grandmother's stepsister, essentially. So I found this little restaurant that some of my distant cousins run. It's a little kind of a roasteria, a little roadside restaurant, and I wrote them this very polite note, and I showed up all excited, and I wanted to learn how they made our family spaghetti sauce. So I sat down, and, you know, I don't speak Italian very well at all, which frustrated them all to no end. They couldn't believe it. And I had an interpreter with me and went through these recipes, and I said, now let's talk about the family sauce. And they had no idea what I was talking about, because there, you know, there's a little bit of a different sauce. Like meatballs, for example, which are a big part of the sauce that I grew up eating. You're not going to put meatballs in a red sauce like that. You know, meatballs are sort of a separate course or eaten differently. So the tomato-based sauce they use would just depend on whether they were using lamb or, I mean, there was just no way I was going to find the sauce recipe. And I said, well, when do you put in the oregano? And they were like, what are you talking, like, you know, they just thought I was crazy, oregano. I mean, I think they, like, by the end of this conversation, the end of the stem, I had a really fun time with them, but I think they thought I was a little off my rocker. They're like, oregano, what is she doing?
I always loved it, even in my family, you know, people would be upset that you didn't speak Italian, and you'd be like, the only Italian I could possibly ever know are the words that I'm not allowed to say.
Right, so, there you go.
Know,
yeah, yeah.
Are the words you call me when you're chasing me with a wooden spoon because I did something wrong.
Exactly, like scustamada, which is kind of like your little pig, you know, like, I don't, that's, the words I know are the ones, yeah.
Exactly. You know, one of the ones I can use on the word bots, you know.
Can you say what it means?
Well, it means kind of stupid. It means, you know, it's just, you're not paying attention.
Right, right. So you got called that a lot.
A lot, yes, very much in my younger days.
But what was interesting, I actually ended up talking to Lydia Bastianich about this, because she studied a lot about immigrant patterns. And really what happens is, you know, as food travels across and travels to a new country, the people really look for, really amplify those flavors that remind them of home. And her theory is that why American-style Italian food is so garlicky is because people really overemphasize the garlic, because that's really what reminded them of home. Or you would get two or three little villages that would be living in, like in our case, upstate Wisconsin, and one of them might have used oregano in a certain sauce, and one of them would use this, and they brought these herbs from home, and they would sort of put them together and make a new sauce. And in our case, you know, it's
Kim?
A very... Yes?
No oregano.
Okay, well, all right. Listen, I'm just saying.
Go ahead, in your case.
This is my story. It's not yours.
Sorry, guys.
But, you know, and it's the same thing with meat. Like, our, you know, my mom always uses beef and pork and sausages. Meatballs is this huge, big platter of meat, which is, would be really unheard of there. You know, meat would be a, you know, it'd be very extravagant to do that, and you just wouldn't put all those meats together. And but I think it says something about the abundance of America, and she was on a farm, and she had 11 kids and had grown up. You know, very poor. I mean, incredibly poor, this village. And, you know, to have all this meat and be able to throw it on a platter is just a big thing. So, you know, there's nothing that looked like the sauce that I grew up eating or that my grandmother even made when I went back to the village. So it was a little bit of a, you know, my romantic notions of going back to this original sauce. But I did find a really interesting story about immigration in this country and how recipes change with the culture and the time. It was just fascinating. I encourage everybody to try to track back some of their family recipes.
Do you know, I remember reading once, I'm sort of a food history nut. I'm actually just kind of a nut in general, and I like food history as well. But I remember reading that the meatball, you know, because in Italy, if you go to Italy, you won't find ever anywhere meatballs in a red sauce. You might find them, as you say, in the
article. Or the big meatballs that we serve here.
You'll find little meatballs in an appetizer and a consomme or an oil or something. But I had read that the meatballs came about because when the Italian immigrants came over, they were serving pasta. And the progressive social workers would find that
You weren't serving enough meat to your kids.
You weren't serving enough meat to your kids. And so this was a reaction to the progressive social workers saying, you poor Italians, you need to eat American. You need to have meat with every meal, every
Isn't
dinner.
That interesting.
And that's where the meatballs came from. Hey,
that's
Kim.
Fascinating.
We have to leave it there. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show. Will you come on the show again?
I absolutely will. Anytime, guys. Give me a call.
Kim, every time we have you on the show, we never finish what we're going to talk about.
I know. Well, we get the next show started. Kim Severs in the New York Times, everybody. You can find out more about her on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Back in just a moment. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:56. Hey, everybody, welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys, talking with Kim Severson and Mark Pascal about Italian food. I'm so bored I could cry.
I love talking about Italian food.
No, I actually do.
I love talking about Grandma. You know,
tell us a story about Grandma, Mark.
Well, Grandma didn't come directly from Italy. She was born and raised her whole life here. Actually, it was her mother who came over as a young girl. So Grandma was really raised in the traditions, and Kathleen Lombardi, one of our restaurants is named after, was raised in American traditions, and her food was the Americanized version of some of these Italian foods that Kim was talking about.
So she served meatballs and red sauce.
She served meatballs and red sauce, and she served that whole platter of meats. And then one of the great things was, when I was growing up, is after the platters of all those meats and after the pasta course, which came out with those, with the meats browned and in red sauce, out they would come with a meat course, which would be lamb or ham or whatever the occasion may be. So there was indeed another meat course which came after that, because you know, my grandparents had achieved a certain amount of affluence, and that was, I guess, part of how you showed that, and the neighbors would come over and eat and snack and the whole thing. But my favorite thing that my grandmother ever made, I this is probably my favorite thing, you'll probably hear me say 10 times if you listen to the show all the time, my favorite thing that my grandmother made, because pretty much all the things my grandmother made were my favorites.
So what is it?
were meatballs, but before the meatballs would go into the gravy, they'd be browned on the stovetop. And those meatballs that were just brown on the stovetop, we used to call the black meatballs, and you eat those right out of the pan, and they're still kind of warm and delicious, and you can taste the richness inside the meatball and the egg flavor and the delicious fat from the meatballs. That was one of those things. You could take the whole rest of the meal and get rid of it if I could have black meatballs. They were the best.
But fortunately, you had the black meatballs and the rest of it.
And then I had dinner, exactly.
Well, here's Catherine Lombardi. Hey, everybody. I hope you've enjoyed listening to this hour of The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys. Central Jersey, 1450. It's 12 noon.